I always felt that sometime, somehow, some way, would convince them that I didn't do this.
In early 2005, Rodney Lincoln has spent almost 23 years behind bars for killing 35-year-old Joanne Tate and attacking her young daughters, 7-year-old Melissa and 4-year-old Renee. His daughter Kay Lincoln is not even close to giving up.
So I called Phil Gibson. He had just been hired for the newly organized Midwest Innocence Project. And I gave him just a small amount of the information I had. And he was stunned. I mean, literally open mouth stunned.
Phil Gibson then meets with Rodney.
And he told me, he says, "Now, I'm not going to ask you if you did this or not. He said, but I will tell you this. We will find out. And if at any point during this investigation you want us to stop, we will." I said, "Phil, I want you to take a good, long look at my case. Then you tell me if I'm guilty."
I'm Leah Rothman. This is The Real Killer, Episode 5, Tell Me If I'm Guilty.
Well, this takes me back. When I was in high school, my best friend and I, at age 14, had a weekend radio show.
Oh, my gosh.
KPRS, Parkville, Missouri, 90.3, playing the hits.
That's Sean O'Brien. He is to law what University of Missouri professor Steve Weinberg is to journalism.
First of all, how did you meet Steve Weinberg?
It's hard for me to go back and say, okay, what's the first time I met Steve? I can't remember. Because it's like I've always been friends with Steve Weinberg. I can't imagine a world in which I wasn't.
And it's in that world, a world where they both are fighting for the wrongfully convicted, that they join forces, pool their talents, and start the Midwest Innocence Project, or MIP, like most people call it. Like Steve, Sean's resume is hard to boil down to one sentence, so I'm not going to even try. Here are some of the highlights.
I really started my career with the Jackson County Public Defender's Office in 1981. I became the chief public defender in 1983, and we were responsible for representing everybody charged with a crime in Jackson County, which is Kansas City, Missouri. And then we did all the death penalty cases in the western third of Missouri. After running the office for about 5 years, I started a nonprofit called the Missouri Capital Punishment Resource Center that represented people on death row. And we did a lot of training of lawyers who were appointed to represent people on death row. And that was where I started encountering innocent clients for the first time. My first 4 exonerations I was involved in were people who were tried, convicted, and sentenced to death in Missouri. And then we were able to uncover new evidence that proved they were innocent. Part of that work was Schlup versus Delo, the U.S. Supreme Court case that actually sets the standard for actual innocence. That's where the term actual innocence comes from, is from the standard announced in that case. So I'm sure you've come across the phrase actual innocence in doing that. And so that was our contribution to the law. So I was really proud to be involved in that landmark litigation.
Sean is also a professor at UMKC School of Law. He's on the board of directors at the Miracle of Innocence, a nonprofit organization that advocates for the wrongfully convicted and helps the innocent with their reentry into society. And he supervises UMKC law students who provide pro bono legal assistance on tough cases, including Rodney's.
I have so many questions. First of all, when you learn about a case where someone claims that they're innocent, do you assume innocence first? I mean, or do you assume guilt and try to prove that they're innocent in order to take on the case? Like, what is the process for you in order to take on a wrongful conviction case?
In making these decisions, I look for red flags. over the years, when people have been exonerated, the New York Innocence Project, Barry Scheck's organization, does statistical analysis of the cases where there have been exonerations. And he looks for risk factors in criminal justice processes that put innocent people at danger. The biggest risk factor, of course, is eyewitness identification, which is what Rodney's conviction is based on. And the second risk factor, another really significant one, is what we call junk science. And hair microscopy that was used in Rodney's case is the queen of junk science. It is horrible stuff.
Basically, it's considered junk science because it's not based on any objective scientific standards. Examiners use a high-powered microscope to compare a crime scene hair to a suspect's hair sample. And if enough characteristics are the same, the examiner calls it a match. Problem is, it's unreliable and highly susceptible to bias because it's the examiner who decides how to describe and assign significance to those characteristics. Without the DNA testing we have today, which they obviously didn't have back in 1982, there's no science to define the characteristics of a human hair that would suggest who the hair actually came from.
The jury was told that Rodney's hair matched a pubic hair that was found at the scene of the crime. It's the quintessential junk science. So Rodney had two of the big risk factors, the hair evidence and the eyewitness testimony. And then when you dig into the eyewitness testimony, you see that, you know, it's testimony of a child. And that risk factor of the unreliability of eyewitness testimony is compounded by really suggestive processes. Detective Joe Burgoon approaches Melissa with two photographs. One photograph of a man named Gary Paris, who is Melissa's half-sister's first cousin, right? A family member. She knows him. And Rodney. Detective Burgoon told Melissa, "We have a magic door in the police station, and the bad man is behind the door. He is one of these two men. If you pick the wrong man, the bad man goes free." And so that's the equivalent in that circumstance of just showing her a picture of Rodney and telling her, pick this guy, this is who we think did it, right? And she's a traumatized 7-year-old girl. And so that's what she does.
A little more context here. It's true. According to the trial transcript from Lou Clenny, Joanne's mother, Melissa and Renee's grandmother, she testified that she heard Detective Burgoon tell Melissa, quote, "We got a magic door downtown, and we have to go look through the magic door and see if you can find the bad man. And if we get the wrong man, we let the bad man go." Lou Clenny also testified that of all the photos Detective Burgoon showed Melissa in the hospital and Melissa said no to, when she's shown Rodney's photo, she says, quote, "She couldn't even hardly get a breath. She said, that's him, and she barely did get it out." It sounds like a pretty dramatic reaction, which may have helped solidify Melissa's IDing of Rodney.
And then they scramble around looking for ways to corroborate that. And I think it's worth remembering that the first jury that heard the evidence against Rodney could not convict him. There was a hung jury. And then in between trial number one and trial number two, they did a lot more testing of the hair. They started testing people who were possible suspects in the case. And they ultimately got 39 people. And they did this little, you know, quasi-scientific or pseudo-scientific test where they looked at all of them under the microscope and said, oh, none of these other people match this hair. And so, you know, that kind of bolstered that hair evidence and they got the conviction.
What did you think of Robert Hampe, Rodney's attorney?
What is very troubling about Mr. Hampe, besides his performance in the courtroom and the fact that he did not do things that a good lawyer, a competent lawyer would have done, is that he himself was a suspect in a homicide case that happened during Rodney's trial. Oh my God. I mean, there was a fraud scheme going on, and the guy was driven out to Illinois, murdered and rolled out of a car on the side of the highway. That was happening while Rodney's trial was starting. That happened the morning of his trial. And I went, oh my God, you know, how does this happen? How do you not make an issue out of that when you're the public defender doing his first post-conviction hearing?
As far as we know, Robert Hampe was never charged with any crimes related to that murder. He was charged with felony theft for that fraud scheme, and years later was disbarred. So MIP decides to take on Rodney's case. And one of the first things they do on March 3rd, 2005, is file a motion to request DNA testing on the physical evidence in the case. In October, the state responds with a motion to dismiss, saying MIP is merely on a fishing expedition. They will go back and forth in the courts for many more months on this. In the meantime, on April 11th, 2006, Rodney is once again up for parole. This time is the first time Melissa will attend. When it's her turn to speak, she leaves nothing on the table.
I kind of come at it from a visceral, very evocative angle, playing on the emotions and the heinous ways the crime was carried out, how vicious it was and bloody, and just how frenetic it was. I played on every emotion that I could in order to make the parole board not listen to him, but listen to me and my uncle. There was nothing that was off limits. I was cutthroat about it, honestly.
Because your goal was what?
To keep him in prison.
The things that she was saying were things she believed.
Kay Lincoln, Rodney's eldest daughter and biggest advocate, is there that day too.
And that's what I told everyone who I talked to during this time frame, because a lot of reporters and investigators and journalists would try to build up this animosity, this war, this, you know, pitting two individuals against each other. And it was never about that for me. And I would tell all of them, I'm not angry at Melissa. I'm angry at some of the things she says because they're not true. But in my mind, Melissa's always going to be a 7-year-old little girl who was just brutalized and just lost her mother. I can never be mad at that child. I used to get so angry at the process because this is his hearing. And this is not Melissa's hearing.
Oh, she would tell him about the suffering and pain she went through. I'm sure she has. And basically plead that if I was ever released, that she would be in fear for her life. And somehow, some reason, I understood that.
You understood what Melissa was saying, because why?
Because of what she was told. We found out by some of the things that their family was told about me. Detective Bagoon told them that when I was arrested, I was high on PCP. And I had scratches on my arms and face. They was the only ones that saw that. My bosses said that I didn't have any scratches on my arms or face. My mother and girlfriend said I didn't have any.
And Detective Burgoon and Skaggs, they saw you a month after the attack.
Yeah, pretty deep scratches, ain't it?
Rodney's 2006 chance at parole is denied. He refuses to take responsibility for the crimes.
I couldn't do that. I was sorry for what happened, but I didn't do it. I couldn't have remorse for what I didn't do. If it meant that I would die in prison, they'd carry my dead body out of prison.
While MIP awaits a decision on the DNA testing, they also file an amended motion to expand the list of items they want to test. And while all this is playing out in the courts, MIP has their staff investigators get to work. One of those investigators is Quinn O'Brien. You met Quinn in episode 2 when she described the gruesome crime scene, what evidence investigators collected, and some of the potential suspects. She knows this case inside and out.
Hi, Quinn.
Hi, Leah. It's good to see you again.
Today, Quinn's a private investigator and an adjunct professor at UMKC School of Law. But back in the day, even before she worked at MIP, she was one of Steve Weinberg's journalism students. And she's also Sean O'Brien's daughter.
I've been doing work for him since I was little. Started pulling staples out of documents and hole-punching documents and things when I was like 9 years old. But by the time I was about 17, 18, 19, I was investigating for him. So I got my degree in journalism and moved out to Washington, D.C. because I thought that I wanted to go into politics. I was wrong. As it turns out, the family business is way more fulfilling. So I joined the Public Defender Service in Washington, D.C. as a staff investigator. And then a couple of summers later, my dad was going to a major innocence hearing with a guy named Dale Helmig. And he talked me into leaving to move back home and do the Dale Helmig hearing with him. At that point, I became the staff investigator for the Midwest Innocence Project. Shortly after that, I got my private investigation license and opened up my own shop. I specialize in criminal defense and innocence cases. I do a lot of cold case homicides. I also do pretrial work. I do capital work. All of my clients are innocent.
Knowing that your dad and Steve Weinberg had already been on the case, did you go in automatically believing in Rodney's innocence, or did you feel like you needed to do your own work to prove to yourself that he was innocent?
I never automatically believe that someone is innocent based on what an attorney or another investigator tells me. And I'm that way on purpose. I need to get into a case and I need to see the evidence for myself. And so even though Steve Weinberg and my dad, both people that I trust very much, said that Rodney Lincoln was innocent, I wasn't convinced yet.
After poring over the evidence for months, Quinn comes to her own conclusion, based heavily on one of the two risk factors Sean O'Brien mentioned earlier, eyewitness identification.
So the very earliest recollections, the very earliest things that Melissa said are going to be more reliable. Children are very suggestible, especially young children, and interviewing them should be done with great care. You can accidentally influence a child very easily. And so the very earliest thing Melissa said, with no prompting, no help, no nothing, was when Uncle Nat shook her and said, "Who did this?" And she says, "Bill. Bill did this." I think Joe Burgoon really meant well. I think he wanted to help Melissa, but he's doing everything wrong. Oh God, I can't say that, can I? I don't know. Well, I guess I can. I can say that. I mean, when he talks to Melissa and Melissa answers his questions, he gives Melissa candy. I'm sure he thinks that he's helping, when really what he's doing is reinforcing with this little girl that when I tell the adults what they want to hear, I get candy.
Quinn learns more. She learns Rodney Lincoln is left-handed, and based on Melissa's testimony, the killer was right-handed. And remember in the grand jury indictment, it said Rodney's nickname was Bad Bill? Well, no one knows where that came from. The only nickname Rodney's ever gone by is Sonny. Then there's this.
There were a lot of leads that were just dropped, like evidence that I wish they would have collected.
When Joanne's family goes to clean up the crime scene, they find a lot of evidence left behind. Yes, it's awful. They were the ones who had to clean it up. Here's Uncle Nat and Aunt Lori.
We found 9 of her fingernails torn off. Press-on nails or something, and they were not easily taken off. Found 9 of them on the floor. Found an ashtray full of cigarette butts, which Joanne didn't smoke.
Yeah.
And found a pair of underwear in the other room where she was dead.
What did you do with that?
We threw it all away because they said they were done.
Remember, this is 1982, and DNA wouldn't be a thing for several more years. It's possible the cigarettes were left by investigators there on the scene that day. Who knows? But Melissa says she saw the killer smoking and watching TV, so maybe those butts could have been important down the road. And the nails? Well, we know Joanne put up a fight. So there's also probably a good chance there could have been some viable DNA recovered, like with the underwear, had they not all been trashed. But Quinn's biggest find is the result of perhaps one person's mistake turning into MIP's good fortune.
I made the trip over to St. Louis from Kansas City to look through the evidence in Rodney's case. And I remember Ed Pustacco and his law clerk handed me a sheet of paper that was an index of all of the evidence, all of the physical evidence, all of the documents, and it was 2 pages. I'm looking at the evidence, I'm going through, I'm making check marks on their index, like, okay, here's the axe handle, here's the axe head, here's knife number 1, here's plastic tumbler number 1, here's the diary, here's the address book, check mark, check mark, check mark. And I get to box 1 and box 2. And I was like, hey guys, what are these things? And why aren't they here? And the law clerk says, oh, those are the Department of Child and Family Services boxes, or the, you know, DFS boxes. Let me go ask Mr. Pustacco about that.
Assistant Circuit Attorney Ed Pustacco and his boss, Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce, are the ones who, as part of their justice project back in 2003, looked at Rodney's case, then closed it, saying basically there's nothing there. Here's Quinn again.
Ed Pustacco came back out and said, yes, you can't have those though, because they're from the Department of Child and Family Services, and so they're confidential. Those are not public like this evidence is, so you can't have those, which means I want them. If you tell me I can't have something, I'm going to want it. I tried my best to get Ed Pustacco to cough up those boxes that day. And I think when he refused, I think that's when I knew that I'd hit something big. They wouldn't be so protective of these boxes if there weren't things in this box that were going to help Rodney Lincoln.
But getting those boxes won't be easy. Again, MIP goes to court, and almost a year later, there's a decision. Ed Pustacco and the Circuit Attorney's Office must turn over the DFS boxes to MIP. What's inside is a treasure trove.
The DFS interviews had a lot of new revelations in them that didn't show up in the police reports.
And a lot of it centers around Melissa and one of the victim's advocates named Mary Flotron. Turns out, Mary and Melissa spend a lot of time together.
Mary Flotron would bathe the girls and help them with, you know, everyday grooming and getting to school. She even stayed with Mary Flotron for a while.
And besides caring for Melissa, Mary is tasked with something else.
Mary Flotron would work with her about her testimony, worked with her before the first and second trials, that essentially walked her through practice testimony in the courtroom, told her where Rodney Lincoln was going to be sitting, and coached her into identifying the person sitting in that chair as the perpetrator.
Here's Mary Flotron talking about some of that, At the time of this 2016 interview, she's 85 years old. She has since passed away.
Our job was to make Melissa and Renee comfortable in the courthouse surroundings, love their attorney so that he could get anything he needed out of them, be comfortable in a courtroom with a judge and that. We were forbade under any circumstances to talk about the crime or anything that had anything to do with the crime. So we stayed away from it.
Mary may not have discussed the specifics of the case with Melissa, but she did talk about the bad man with her. That's what they would call the person who hurt the girls. And it turns out there was more than just one bad man. Here's Quinn again.
Melissa, she identified multiple men as her attacker. She would, you know, call everyone the bad man, which is, you know, what the social workers had started to call the person who did this to her, the bad man. Melissa identified the prosecutor as the bad man at some point. Clearly the prosecutor, Joe Bauer, is not the attacker, but Melissa identified him. She hid her head and pointed at him and said, "That's the bad man, the bad man." And that's in the DFS records. It speaks to the unreliability of Melissa's identification of Rodney Lincoln that she more than once identified other men as the bad man.
Here's Mary Flotron again from that 2016 interview.
You want to hear the story about the bad man. Melissa adored me, and she was going home for the weekend with me. And it was very shortly before the trial, like a weekend ahead of time or two. So we're making a stop sign on 14th Street right before you get to Lafayette. So we were talking about clothes and what she was going to wear. We were going to go to a restaurant for dinner and who was going to be there. And she all of a sudden starts turning toward me in the driver's seat and scrunching up and putting her head down, which was the way that she would act when we first met her. And I said, "Melissa, honey, what is wrong?" Made my stop sign, continued on. She said, "You said that guy was the bad guy." I said, "Oh, honey, now, how many times have I told you Joe put the bad guy in jail? And he's not going to get out and hurt little kids anymore." And I thought, "That guy on the corner, wasn't he a black man?" "I don't know." I said, "Well, I think he was, and your bad guy was a white man. So that couldn't be your bad guy at all." "Oh, well, all right."
So for Rodney's team, finding those files and what's in them is a game changer.
I'm pretty sure that the law clerk was not supposed to have handed me that index of evidence. I'm pretty sure I was never supposed to find out about the DFS boxes.
I wanted to know more about those DFS boxes Quinn discovered and what the circuit attorney's office had to say about their review of Rodney's case. So I reached out to the former circuit attorney, Jennifer Joyce, and her former assistant circuit attorney, Ed Bistocco, to see if they'd be willing to talk with me. Over the course of several emails and a couple of phone calls with their PR person, who vetted me like I have never been vetted before, it sounded like it may happen. But then all communication dropped off. Months later, Jennifer Joyce declined to be interviewed, but provided me with a statement. She said in part, quote, "Mr. Lincoln's case was identified in the initial phase as suitable for comprehensive review and testing. Ultimately, the review and testing failed to yield information that was probative to the guilt or innocence of Mr. Lincoln. I'm not aware that we ever officially closed the case." And about those DFS boxes, Jennifer Joyce said this, quote, "At the present time, I don't have any recollection of DFS boxes." As of right now, I still haven't heard back from Ed Bistocco. Remember, back in 2005, the MIP lawyers filed an amended motion to have the DNA testing done on the evidence. They amended it again in 2006. After 5 years of back and forth with the circuit attorney's office, Ed Pistacco says yes, the evidence can be tested, including the now recovered fingernail scrapings, which had been lost. So all of it is sent from St. Louis to a lab in California. MIP will pay for the testing. Almost 11 months later, the lab delivers their final report. Although the fingernail scrapings are too degraded to yield any results, there is a bombshell. None of the other physical evidence tested matches Rodney, including the hair found on the blue blanket, which was used against him at trial. Here's Rodney's daughter, Kay Lincoln.
That was the best news I had ever heard in my entire life. I thought, this is it. He's home. We're done. It's not his hair. It wasn't only that hair. There were other hairs that were found that had never been brought up at trial. There was a hair found on Renee in her genital area that also was not my dad's. There was another hair found that also was not my dad's. They tested three hairs. They tested some things that were found with blood on them to see if, you know, that had his DNA. Nothing that they tested had his DNA. I believe it was 12 pieces of evidence that was tested in 2010. Nothing had his DNA. So, you know, you're thinking, what a great Christmas this is gonna be.
Melissa has a very different reaction.
I was very angry. I went to war. I formulated my own form of PR and disaster control. I was scorched earth when it came to talking about Kay and Rodney. I was not nice. I was extremely derogatory. I was fully intent on destroying any bit of credibility. I said that Rodney was absolutely a murderer. No question, no doubt. Only a moron would believe him.
MIP lawyers file an immediate motion to release Rodney, citing the DNA report, flaws in the investigation, and identification procedure. In April 2011, Rodney opts out of his parole hearing, thinking he'll be exonerated and home soon. But MIP knows better than to hold out hope, so they keep digging for even more evidence to bolster their case. Here's Quinn again.
Dan Grothaus, is he on your list of witnesses to, or people to talk to?
I don't know who that is.
Oh no, how do you not know who Dan is? Okay.
I've never heard that name before.
He is my sort of mentor. And Dan Grothaus was definitely very heavily involved with Rodney Lincoln's case.
This is one of those times during this re-examination of the case where I'm realizing how much I don't know. Remember, I've told some versions of this story before for TV, but I've never been able to go this deep and uncover so much. So, yeah, that's why I've never heard of Dan Grothaus. Kind of embarrassing.
Could you make an introduction?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Dan would love that. Dan does not get the credit that he deserves.
Hi, Dan. It's really nice to meet you.
Hi, Leah. Leah. Okay.
So thank you so much for doing this. Tell me first a little bit about yourself. Tell me about your background, how and why you became an investigator.
I started out in J school, Missouri J school. And then I went down to Houston and worked for the Houston Chronicle and then the Houston Post for several years. While at the Houston Chronicle, I did a project for the local PBS station there, a documentary. Ended up winning an Emmy. PBS, I was to actually produce three documentaries on the criminal justice system. And we weren't able to get funding, and so I started working for a private investigator down there for lack of anything else better to do at the time. I'd worked a couple of criminal cases and enjoyed the work. And then I started, I think my first Innocence Project case was in 1993. Actually, some nuns from California sent us some money to look into a case of a fellow by the name of Gary Graham, who was about to be executed. And I found the witness who witnessed the crime and knew that the man they had at the courtroom, the man was on trial, was not the guy that shot the person that she saw shoot him at the Kroger store. Gary Graham spent the next 10 years on death row waiting for a chance to go to court for any kind of an evidentiary hearing. It was thrilling to find a witness that could help somebody find justice. It was extremely frustrating to see Gary Graham languish because the laws and the lawyers could not figure out how to get him back into court to get a fair evidentiary hearing. He was denied repeatedly and executed 10 years later. I read in the paper that it took several guards to drag him to the chamber to execute him. That was disappointing, to say the least, frustrating. To me, it did illuminate the whole situation with the system that we have.
Almost 20 years after Dan works on Gary Graham's case, he picks up Rodney's in 2011.
Rodney Lincoln's conviction of the investigation of the Joanne Tate murder was so inferior in my estimation in every way. This is, to me, a classic innocence case because nobody did their job.
So were there actually viable suspects?
Well, we don't know. That's an area that had to have been done in 1982. That was when they had the best opportunity to develop a list of suspects. And by suspects, I mean, you know, all of her boyfriends that could have had this intention. I found neighbors that had never been contacted by the police, neighbors who consistently said that Joanne had a long line of male visitors coming over to her apartment. And this were neighbor after neighbor, people she went to church with, the woman who lived above the apartment who heard everything every night. I mean, these were credible witnesses that 30 years later could still recall that Joanne had a lot of male friends. They also talked about what a wonderful mother she was and how doting she was over her daughters and how Joanne took care of herself and she was dressed very well. These were not people who were bad-mouthing Joanne at all. They were simply observing that in one neighbor's words, she was boy crazy. The upstairs neighbor heard the girls talking to the men often. There's your pool of suspects. You usually go for the ex-husband or the ex-boyfriend. In this case, there were dozens.
Did some of the ex-boyfriends and ex-husbands have violent pasts, criminal records?
I think they all probably did. It wasn't hard to find men in her past who had some history of violence or some incident of violence. There was nothing in her past that reduced the pool of possibilities. Police didn't even look at how large the pool was.
For the record, no one is judging Joanne for having men in her life. I mean, don't even get me started on double standards. It's only a topic of conversation because it directly relates to the pool of potential suspects. And in terms of that pool of potential suspects, there are many men's names, some with short entries about them, in Joanne's diary. Most are positive. But then there's this one from May 17th. It says, quote, "Met Rich. Didn't like him. He pushed his way to stay night. He is a big guy, owns a car lot. His number is in this book." And then on June 14th, there's one that says, "Bill called, 11 o'clock. I mean, who is Bill? And who is Rich? I mean, to Dan's point, did police ever find and talk to either of them? But there is one person during Dan's investigation who piques his interest more than most.
Stephen Yancey came to our attention. It turned out he was a teenager who was living in the neighborhood with his grandparents, I think. Turned out he had had problems where he was living with his mom and stepfather. He was had a violent, sexually dysfunctional history. I interviewed relatives of his who listed the 5 or 6 or 7 people in his family and in his neighborhood who he had molested. These were all younger people, younger than him. He was 16 or 17 at the time. He was one of the first witnesses on the scene who the police interviewed, and that stuck with me.
Remember, Melissa was shown Steve Yancey's photo, and she said she knew him, but he was not the perpetrator. In 1983, Melissa was asked in a deposition about who would stay with her and Renee when their mom would go out on dates, and she said this in part, quote, "There's this boy around the block, and he was mom's friend, and his name was Steven. Sometimes he came around and babysat at us."
We found Steve Yancey in prison in Kansas on a violent sexual crime. He's still in prison.
In 2008, Steve Yancey is convicted of kidnapping and misdemeanor sexual battery of an 11-year-old boy. He is eligible for parole in 2024. I continue my conversation with criminal defense investigator Dan Grothaus.
The first page of Joanne's diary said, "I'm only writing all this down in case something would happen to me. You would know who to look for, people I was with." Tell me, I mean, that seems pretty ominous, and that Joanne was almost predicting that something may happen to her. Why, in your investigation, what did you learn about her? Why do you think Joanne was scared?
Well, I also interviewed a witness, a neighbor, who said the same thing, that she remembered that the day before, the night she was killed, she told the neighbor, "If you hear any noises, call the police because there's a possibility something bad may happen," something to that effect. And this neighbor remembered that again 30 years later. Whether or not she ever told the police that, I don't know. It wasn't in any police report. Joanne had a lot of drama in her life. It's possible that she was just simply being dramatic when she put that in her diary, or when she said that to the neighbor. Or it could have been, you know, ominously prophetic, that maybe she was worried that something, that she had a date with somebody that, you know, she was worried about. You don't really know how to read that, but you certainly have to put that in your pile of facts or possibilities.
I mean, she slept with a hatchet under her mattress. Also next to the hatchet was a Hustler magazine that was open to the page, "Slaughter of the Innocents." Did you ever make anything of that?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, that's too random. Unless you found a serial killer who claimed that they brought the magazine with them and, you know, left a message. But it doesn't mean anything unless you find somebody that attributes some meaning to it, at least the way I would look at it.
Based on the evidence photos, there are several fingerprints circled on the magazine, but only 2 have a name next to them: Jerry Woodward. He was Joanne's boyfriend at the time of the murder, and he was there with Uncle Nat the morning they found Joanne and the girls. For the record, Rodney was fingerprinted twice, and there was an officer back in 1982 who said one print on a knife matched Rodney. But during that officer's deposition, he asked for an off-the-record conversation. When they returned, he said he was unwilling to testify at trial about that print matching Rodney unless the FBI testified to the same. That officer never testified.
What did you learn about Rodney?
I didn't learn very much about Rodney. That was not part of my task. my task was to find out what happened, and none of it pointed to Rodney, so I was looking elsewhere. He did, in fact, have an alibi. I did talk to his girlfriend at the time, and I believe he woke up that morning, like every other morning, and took her to her house. And then he showed up at work, I believe, at either 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. as normal, and worked his regular job as he always did. There was nothing odd about his movements that day, the day before, the day after. And my thoughts were that this was just the police wanting to not believe her and wanting to not believe the time clock that said he punched in as he normally did. That just baffled me that his alibi was not at least considered, let alone, you know, be considered significant. There was nothing about his lifestyle or his activities in 1982 to indicate he had anything to do with this.
Even though he had killed a man before?
This crime was committed with a purpose by somebody who had a real twist to their psyche. You know, there was some sexual torture involved that led me to believe, you know, not taking any classes past psych one, that there was something, you know, weird about the person who committed this crime. And I remember asking the detective if he knew what Rodney's motive was to commit this crime. And he said no. He said he didn't give it much thought.
On March 24th, 2012, MIP files a motion asking for more DNA testing. They're hoping to find the DNA profile of the real killer. A year later, and it seems like everything takes at least a year, in April of 2013, the report comes back. There are no new profiles developed. Some of the evidence was too degraded, and the remaining evidence was shown to have the victim's blood in them. 5 months later, in an evidentiary hearing, MIP argues for Rodney's release. The state opposes it. So, if you're keeping track, they first found out in 2010, none of the physical evidence matched Rodney, and his attorney started arguing for his release. 3 years go by. It's now December of 2013, and the judge has made her decision. Here's Kay again.
We waited, and we waited, and we waited. And on Christmas Eve, 2013, I got a phone call from my dad's attorney saying that the judge was not releasing him. She said that, yes, everyone is in agreement that this hair did not come from him, but that was not the linchpin of the case. The linchpin of the case was Melissa's testimony. And the eyewitness testimony still stands. And that is still enough to convict him, so she would not be reversing the conviction. And I was so defeated and so devastated. What else can you do? I mean, you've been fighting now for 10 years for this one day, and somebody just pulls the plug on you.
But something's about to happen that may change everything. Here's Uncle Nat.
We went to a parole hearing, and we're sitting there, and we're hearing Rodney come in, and I'm just so far away from him, and I just felt like, you know what, I'm just so, that guard is not going to stop me from getting to him. I mean, I'm powerful. And I just want it so bad to hurt him, you know.
But he doesn't. Instead, he sits and listens.
He said, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do this. And there was just something in his voice that day when I heard him that didn't sound like he did it. It just all kind of come to me. Do they really got the right guy?
Next time on The Real Killer.
He did not kill my mom. He didn't hurt me or my sister. He wasn't there.
One shocking revelation leads to another.
See that face? I know that face. I know that face is Bill.
But Melissa changing her story after so long does not go over well.
You're not going to shut me up. I've met death and I've been abused. I'm not afraid of anything anymore. Bring it.
A quick note. Many listeners have reached out saying they'd like to see the lineup photo and other materials related to the case. To check them out, click the link in the episode description and let us know what you think. The Real Killer is a production of AYR Media and iHeartRadio, hosted by me, Leah Rothman. Executive producers Leah Rothman and Aliza Rosen for AYR Media. Written by me, Leah Rothman. Senior Associate Producer Eric Newman. Editing and sound design by Cameron Taggy. Mixed and mastered by Cameron Taggy. Audio engineering by Jesus C. Murillo. Studio engineering by Tom Weir and Kelly McGrew. Legal counsel for AYR Media, Gianni Douglas. Executive producer for iHeartRadio, Chandler Mays. If you're enjoying The Real Killer, tell your friends about it and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.